And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. Well, this hour we begin by delving into child abuse prevention. It's been a pressing problem in Florida, but an abuse hotline has shown a steady increase in usage. Joining us now is psychologist and therapist Dr. Oren Wunderman. He's the executive director of the Family Resource Center of South Florida. Welcome to you, Doctor. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Also with us is attorney Stephen Pennypacker, deputy director and training director for Children's Legal Services for the Department of Children and Family Services for the state of Florida. Welcome to you, Mr. Pennypacker.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Dr. Wunderman, let's begin with this Protection of Vulnerable Persons Act. Can you tell us about it and its ramifications?
I can give you the summary, and I'm certain that Mr. Pennypacker can tell it to you in more detail. Essentially, this arose from the Jerry Sandusky concerns, and there was one person in particular, Ron Book, who is a well-known lobbyist in South Florida. He's the one who pushed this forward, and essentially the additions are as follows. In the past, the abuse law said that if you suspected abuse, exploitation, or neglect of a child by a caretaker or parent, you are required by statute to report it. And now it's been expanded so that if you suspect abuse, exploitation, or neglect of a child by any adult, then you're required to report it. So that's one addition. The other addition is that state schools and public schools now have a very strong mandate to report. And if they fail to report, they can be fined $1 million. No one can hide behind a big institution such as, maybe
Penn State.
That's right. Exactly right. So essentially, it basically codifies that people, if they suspect abuse, exploitation, or neglect, they need to report it to the Florida Abuse Registry.
Stephen Pennypacker, anything to add to that?
No, I think that is absolutely correct. That's the basis of the statute. The change went into effect on October 1st, and obviously we've seen an increase in the number of calls to our hotline as a result of it. One thing I would add is that when the calls come into DCF, they will be transferred to law enforcement for the non-caregiver abuse. So while DCF does accept the call, it will be pushed over to usually either your local sheriff's department or the local agency that would be responsible for investigating the crime.
How about safeguards for the accused? Someone with a grudge could make life unbearable for someone who's innocent because it goes right to the sheriff's office.
There's a penalty for false reporting. That's always been in the statute, and that is a third-degree felony now. So if the DCF determines, or for a child abuse report, that it's a false report, then people can be prosecuted for that. That would hold the same for a non-caregiver report as well.
What about a misunderstanding where somebody perceives abuse that's actually they're disciplining a child or they're punishing a child for whatever reason, and it's perceived as abuse and reported?
There's an immunity for good faith reporting. It's in Florida Statute 39.205, Section 9. So you're not civilly liable if you make a good faith report. So if you believe something is happening and you call it in, then you're not accountable if it turns out that it's not actually abuse.
So it's investigated, though, thoroughly, the one that is where the abuse is. What
right.
I mean is it's not just the person that's not liable. It's also that they investigate thoroughly and they find it's not abuse.
Correct. I mean, the intent of the statute, as with all abuse reporting, is that you have an investigation if there is reasonable suspicion. So that if someone sees something or becomes aware of something, they call it in. And then it's up to either DCF if it's for a child, or for law enforcement if it's for an adult, or on a child that's not a caregiver, then they would investigate. But again, the intent of the statute is to have somebody investigate the allegations, not just to not call them in at all.
That statewide abuse number is 1-800-96-ABUSE, 1-800-96-ABUSE. Stephen Pennypacker, about how many calls statewide does that line receive a day?
It gets thousands every month. The calls per day are in the thousands as well. As the estimates were that we would receive an additional 40,000 new calls as a result of this statute.
You say thousands a day?
Not a day, no. Thousands per month.
Per month.
the estimate was that we would get 40,000 new calls as a result of this statute, and my understanding is we've actually received more at a higher rate than what we anticipated.
I read that Florida is one of the three deadliest states for children. How is that? Why is that?
I'm not sure what that's coming from. I mean, there are certain requirements for states to report with abuse and neglect. We do report drownings as a result of requirements, and so I think Florida ends up being a little bit higher because accidental drownings would be reported.
I see. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Dr. Oren Wunderman. He's the Executive Director of Family Resource Center of South Florida. And also Attorney Stephen Pennypacker. He is Director and Training Director for Children's Legal Services for the Department of Children and Families. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Tell me, Dr. Oren Wunderman, what are the signs for parents and caregivers to look for that abuse is indeed going on?
Well,
it's always not very obvious.
Yes, it can range from very obvious to subtle. The obvious things would be such things as bruises. You would see things like the child is still wearing the same clothes, the child hasn't taken a bath or a shower, child is inordinately hungry, you know, child has had a non-treated cut or infection for a long period of time. And then moving into physical or sexual abuse, what I observed, I was a psychologist for the child protection team for several years. You see kids have a startle reflex, kids have trouble sleeping normally, eating normally. They're overreactive in class, overreactive with their friends. And then going even further on into the symptomatology, kids who've been regularly subjected to sexual abuse, they become what's referred to as sexually reactive, and they will start doing some of those things either to other kids or to animals.
Being promiscuous.
Yeah, they'll be exhibiting,
unduly promiscuous.
Yeah, they'll be exhibiting sexualized behavior at school or at aftercare or, as I say, unfortunately, with animals as well.
How much of the abuse stems from the Internet?
Well, that's a very good question. Unfortunately, you can see everything under the sun in the Internet now, and I do urge parents to set up those parental controls and make sure that, certainly for younger kids, that all those devices are in some public place so a parent can walk by and see what a child is observing. I'd have to say I think kids are being exposed to very explicit normal and abnormal sexuality, and that's why I really think parents need to set up controls and have conversations with the kids early.
Should parents have passwords of social networks that their young children are participating on, adolescents?
My opinion is yes. You know, they can get exposed to things pretty quickly that they're really not able to handle well, so my opinion is yes.
I see you have this campaign, the Child Abuse Prevention Campaign. How is that progressing? That's the Family Resource Centers.
Right. Really, the goal of that is to raise people's awareness about child abuse, the signs and symptoms, as I've discussed. But the other thing is to point out that average citizens can make a difference. They can make a phone call. If you see things that you're concerned with, having called the abuse registry many times, I can tell you they're very thoughtful in taking histories, and they will be helpful in figuring out whether it seems to be a valid concern.
Stephen Pennypacker, tell us more about you're in charge of training at the Children and Family Services. What kind of training do you give and to whom?
My responsibility is primarily for training our attorneys that appear in court representing the state of Florida in dependency actions. The state of Florida is now shifting our focus as a result of a statute that also went into effect last year. Instead of assessing risk, we're now going to be assessing safety, and that is causing a complete transformation of the entire abuse system in Florida. So primarily, we are looking at that at this point, but we train for trial skills, we train for introduction of evidence, we train for issues related to adoptions. We have a statute in Florida that allows for what's known as an intervention into a dependency case where the parents can actually ask that their child be adopted by someone rather than having the state of Florida do the termination of parental rights. So there's many issues that come up in our day-to-day work that we try to keep current and have our attorneys be as prepared as they can to go to court.
What kind of training do the operators who answer that 1-800-96-ABUSE line go through?
They have fairly extensive training as they're going to the job. Obviously, we don't let them answer the phone until they're comfortable in talking to people on the phone. They have a set criteria of information that they need to get in order to either screen the call in or screen it out. Not every call is accepted for referral down to the field for an investigator to go through. So they receive lots of training before they get on the call.
What kind of percentage of the calls that you receive are referred to authorities? Ballpark.
Ballpark would be about 60%. Those numbers vary, obviously, but I'm not in the hotline day-to-day, so we probably need our hotline director to give you the actual numbers.
Why do you feel child abuse and neglect is increasing in the state of Florida? Is that nationwide that it's increasing, or Florida in particular?
I'm not sure you can actually say that child abuse itself is increasing. I think awareness clearly is increasing, and as a result of that, you get more attention to it. So that with the more calls and more investigations and more publicity related to it, then it looks like you have more abuse when, in fact, it may have been going on at the same rates over time. We just didn't become aware of it.
Right.
Well, I certainly agree that reporting it seems to be going up because awareness is going up. I do think during long, grinding recessions, child abuse tends to go up because people are very stressed. They may have had significant financial reversals. They may be living in inordinately cramped quarters, and they may be drinking and drugging, and they're just more reactive. So I think prolonged recessions are a factor. And and having worked in the juvenile court in my first practicum since 1978, I can say that the DCF attorneys are, I think, are heroic. I think they do an outstanding job. Caseloads are large, and I think they do an outstanding job of trying to keep kids safe and whenever possible, trying to reunify families safely.
We have an emailer. I guess this is for you, Mr. Pennypacker. Is it really so that Florida, this is Rita, is it really so that Florida has a 10-year statute of limitation for reporting sexual abuse?
I'm not aware of a statute of limitations for sexual abuse. When I've been asked questions about, well, how long ago can something have happened before you call it in, I think if you look at the facts of the Sandusky case, you would want people to report abuse that occurred years ago because the perpetrator may still be out there. So I don't believe there's a statute of limitation on reporting at all.
Okay.
What really qualifies as, say, physical abuse? I could see maybe a mother with an unruly kid in Walmart, and she gives them some pretty hard whacks on the rear. When does it become just corporal punishment, and when is it abuse, Doctor?
Well, that's a very good question, and there, you know, attorneys sometimes use the expression bright line. Is there a bright line that discriminates between reasonable corporal punishment and abuse? I'm not aware of a bright line if there is, but I can say if it leaves injury and if it is done exclusively for the parent to discharge rage rather than just get the child's attention, I think that's abuse. If it goes on in a prolonged way, that's abuse. Certainly if it draws blood, that's abuse. But there are some instances that are gray, but overall, I think, in my opinion, corporal punishment should only be used very, very briefly and only to get the child's attention and not just to discharge parental rage.
Well, as a professional, would you dissuade parents from using any form of corporal punishment?
Well, here's the guideline I personally used when my kids were young, is that on those rare occasions when they were getting ready to do something dangerous, like repeatedly running out in the street or failing to put on their seatbelt, I gave them I pre-warned them and gave them a little whack on the tush. And that was it. So that's the extent of corporal punishment that I use. So that's my advice. Give them a pre-warning. Make it very brief just to get the child's attention.
I would add, too, the excessive corporal punishment is actually defined in statute. It's in 39.01, Section 32 under the definition of harm. And there's a list of physical injuries that would be considered excessive corporal punishment. As Dr. Wunderman listed, sprains, dislocations, bones, skull fractures. If you read the list, you'll see that it's pretty clear what is excessive corporal punishment.
What about dad's belt?
Dad's belt would not be excessive unless you have excessive bruising. So unfortunately, we have cases where the belt can be used from the middle of the back all the way down to the middle of the thighs, and you get children that are bruised from that entire area. That's excessive. But simply just using a belt in and of itself would not be excessive corporal punishment.
Let's take a call or two. We've got Veritza, is that correct, in Miami? Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I wanted to talk a little bit about school. And because I'm a school counselor, and I've worked at several schools, elementary, middle schools, and I've also worked in private and charter schools. And I have found that a lot of teachers are not trained on what to do if a child reveals that they're being abused, or that they feel suicidal, or that they want to hurt themselves or others. And I find that that's not included in a teaching program at a university level. And a lot of charter schools, they're not required to have a school counselor. The teachers are not trained on what to do when this happens. And also private schools, the teachers are not even, they're not required to even have a bachelor's degree or even a school counselor, and they don't know what to do. And it's a problem, because they should be trained on what to do and the numbers. And it's responsibility of the school counselor to do it. And if there's not one, in a school, then it becomes an issue for the safety of the student.
Okay. Doctor, you want to?
Well, in public schools, that's supposed to be part of their orientation. And in fact, I have participated in the building just next door in the Dade County Public School teaching of teachers about what to do. It should be part of the orientation, and teachers should know that, and Mr. Pennypacker can address this probably with a lot of specificity. There is a provision that says if a teacher makes a good faith report, if there's any retaliation, there's a presumption that it's retaliation, and so a teacher has a lot of protections. So my opinion is that people should ask for the training, and when in doubt, call the abuse registry to ask.
I would agree with that. I mean, again, the intent of the statutes is to make the report, so that we can do what we can to investigate and then determine whether there is, in fact, abuse occurring. People that report in good faith should be immune from any kind of negative consequences from that. If we didn't have that, then we would chill people calling the hotline or making web-based reporting, and we don't want that.
Mr. Pennypacker, the law also requires teachers in grade 1 through 12 to undergo training to identify potential victims of abuse, and is funded also to relocate potential victims. What does that mean?
The relocation of the potential victims, I believe, is in the human trafficking area, so that when you have children that are in a particular location where they are being put out for services that we would not want them to be, you need to get them out of that geographic area so that those people can't find them or have contact with them.
What is this interstate compact on the placement of children?
That's a law that all the states have adopted, and what it does is it governs the movement of children between states. So let's just say that we take a child into custody there in Miami, and the grandmother lives in Illinois. In order for us to be able to make that placement into Illinois, we have to go through the interstate compact. We would make a request to Illinois. They would go out and do a home study on the grandmother and make a determination on whether it was contrary to the child's welfare to have the child placed there. If they determine that it is okay, then we would make that placement. So we have a law so we don't just move children ad hoc from here to there and there's not services or it's not an appropriate placement. We don't want to put children across state lines without knowing that where we're putting them is a good placement for them.
Okay. Let's move along to another caller. This is Linda in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. I'm actually a teacher in a school for severely special needs students, and I had an incident this year where I suspected abuse and reported it as directed by my principal to the school social worker. And when I felt she hadn't done enough about it, I did report it to DCF. My understanding was that they called the school to clarify with the social worker what was going on, and that nothing happened after that because they were satisfied with what the social worker told them. And I was concerned because, frankly, I don't feel the social worker is doing her job correctly. Does this happen often where someone else can intervene and explain away the situation and an investigation of the home is not done?
Who'd like to take that?
I'll take just the portion I know, and probably Mr. Pennypacker knows it further. It's my understanding they're supposed to lay eyes on the alleged victim and interview to the extent possible. And in my experience, having called the abuse registry on and off for 35 years, that does not happen often, that they are supposed to speak to the alleged victim and do an assessment directly that way.
That's correct. Calls, when they are accepted for referral, they are coded into one of two ways. There's either an immediate or within 24 hours, and as Dr. Wunderman said, one of the requirements is that the investigator see the child. So So the description of the call that you made would not be consistent, but you know, I would not want to make a comment on a particular call without knowing all the details of why particular actions were taken. But yes, children should be seen if the call is accepted.
We have an emailer, Miami, Mary in Miami. My neighbor was repeatedly reported over the course of several weeks as abusing her children by some anonymous person. As the closest neighbor, living next door to them for 10 years and seeing the children almost daily, I know the accusation not to be true. They were visited by the police and family services each time. Family services inquired at the children's schools. She and her husband had to be drug tested. My husband and I went with them to family services to support them, and I spoke to the police once they came to the house. It made the family's life a mess for weeks. I understand how an accusation must be investigated, but how can the authorities catch an anonymous accuser?
Well, I can tell you that within the realm of child custody disputes, there are a lot of false allegations, and all of the professionals involved in vetting an abuse complaint when it's in the context of a custody dispute have to be very careful, and I have seen a lot of false complaints with respect to child custody arena. If someone is repeatedly being falsely accused, then I think, and Mr. Pennypacker can address this in more detail, I think they can just say, look, you've now found me not to be abusing for the last three investigations. Can you please go back to your source and see what's up with your source?
And as far as the anonymous calling, there is caller ID, so that even though it is anonymous, if you've got a false report, if there is caller ID available for that call and law enforcement wants to pursue it, then they could come back to the hotline and say, look, this is a continual false report and we want to go forward and do something to try to determine who is actually making these calls. If there's no way to identify the caller, then it's a very difficult situation to try to...
Okay, we're getting kind of close to the end of our segment. If your caller is to be brief, David in Miami, you're up. Hi.
Hi, thank you. Wonderful program. Recently, I was falsely accused, and I think that I have enough information about it. If I were to proceed with a case forensically, I could prove the fact of who has done it. But I'm always concerned because I know the police department is very busy. And over time in my commercial life, I've had situations where what I thought was a good case did not go never went forward.
Do you have a question for the guests?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't. I guess my question would be, if I have one, how do I proceed with this trying to file a false report?
You would call your local law enforcement agency, so either your sheriff's department or your city police. I would start with the sheriff's department.
Okay, and this emailer is the same one that emailed earlier about the statute of limitations. Friend of mine went to report sexual abuse when she was 11 to 14. Now she's 26, and the police said there's a statute of limitations of 10 years in Broward.
It seems like a lot of the accused priests, their abuse had gone on longer than 10 years.
I defer to the attorney. I don't really know.
Yeah, Mr. Pennypacker?
About the...
I don't know the statute of limitations for the criminal conduct. As far as reporting, we would certainly want people to call for the same reasons that I said before. We don't want people out there that have been doing this for years to go undetected or uninvestigated because something occurred a long time ago. So as far as the criminal statute of limitations, I don't know the statute number on that.
Mr. Pennypacker, before we go, give us a thumbnail of how the new law affects life in Florida.
It's a change so that we know, because of radio programs like this and going around and doing presentations and just people having the discussion, that those people who are doing things to children that they should not be doing, that hopefully we can find them and investigate and take the appropriate action to protect children so that we don't have situations like Penn State or anything else where you have someone that's able to go on for years because nobody calls it in.
Okay, we want to give that toll-free abuse hotline number again. It's 1-800-96-ABUSE. I don't know what that translates to.
1-800-96-ABUSE.
Right.
That ought to do it. Well, we certainly want to thank you. We've been visiting with psychologist and therapist Dr. Orrin Wunderman. He's the executive director of the Family Resource Center of South Florida. Thank you very much, Dr. Wunderman.
Thank you. As usual, it's been a pleasure.
And also, we've been speaking with the Deputy Director of Training for Children's Legal Service, for the Florida Department of Children and Family Services. That's attorney Stephen Pennypacker. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Good afternoon. I'm Bonnie Berman. Our food and dining segment has finally arrived. We're joined by chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, we always keep tabs on South Florida restaurants on the program, those that open, those that close, or that get new chefs. And we have someone in the studio today who really knows the score, right?
Yes, she certainly does. She does. Have you noticed there's been an explosion, Bonnie, of new restaurants
yes.
opening? I mean, even off-season, there are so many, and unfortunately, a lot of closings. It's hard to keep up with the news. And so I've asked our guest today to come here and help us out with the South Florida restaurant scene. She's Victoria Pesch Elliott. You might know her name because she's the Miami Herald restaurant critic. So welcome, Victoria.
Hi, great to be here.
Wonderful to have us with us. And also with us is our favorite wine columnist. That's Fred Tasker. You can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what's in your glass today?
Hey, Victoria. Long time no see. Nice
Hi,
to be on
Fred.
The program with you.
Thank
Thought
you.
I'd talk about taking your own wine to restaurants.
That's always a good topic. The old corkage fee.
Yeah, well, we'll have a lot to say about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start right away. Victoria Pesch Elliott, so many restaurants are opening. What's going on?
You know, I think Miami is so hot right now that restaurants are opening, homegrown restaurants, independents, out-of-towners, out of the country. Everyone's, you know, moving and looking towards Miami, and it's a hot destination. So there's a lot of money here, and there's building going on, so it's booming. It's booming again. So people want to, there's more people spending money on food now than ever before in restaurants.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And are these restaurants filling? I mean, are they?
You know, no, there's not enough for everybody to, you know, at the moment. But I think that there's expansion is looking towards the future, that there will be enough. But places are also closing at a rapid pace. I think the money that goes into opening a restaurant is so high right now that places can't afford to sort of stay open unless they're an immediate hit. I'm seeing places closing faster than I've ever seen them close.
And it's really such a shame because they spend so much money opening and then they open in our slow season.
Well, I think that's not intentional. You know, within Miami, building, delays, things happening on their own time, you know.
So how long would you say that they're open? You say you've seen
that? I've seen places close in less than 3 or 4 months.
Oh, they don't even give it the first year.
No. I mean, I've seen a good half dozen places close before they make their first year, which I think is really tragic. As you say, Linda, they put so much money into the build out, and then they're gone.
And they're gone. So, is there a pattern? Is it the location? Is it the price? What are you finding?
I think that the restaurants that tend to succeed have a very clear vision of what they're doing. They've either established themselves somewhere else, or they're corporately owned, and they've done it somewhere else. They've got a formula that works. They've got a clear vision. They know what they're doing. They've trained their staff really well. They're clean, and they're cleanly, smoothly running, and they know how to make it work. There's not a lot of room for error. There's not a lot of room for, you know, testing things out.
Victoria, so, is there a kind of a set amount of money that a restaurant has to expect to lose over the first few months that they, if they don't have that kind of nest egg, they shouldn't even be opening?
I think that's a really good point. I think that they need operating expenses for, you know, I'm not a financial person necessarily, but from, you know, the talks that I've had and interviews I've done with restaurants, they need to at least expect the first 6 to 8 months, maybe even a year, to even start breaking even. They need, you know, that much in reserve to be able to pay their staff, buy their supplies. They can't expect to be
making a profit
right
away.
Well,
if you're closing 3 months, you maybe shouldn't have even opened.
Exactly.
Right.
And they don't, yeah, I think a lot of inexperienced restaurateurs don't really understand that.
Well, the other thing is, I'm always wondering, why are the prices so high? They're higher in many cases than New York City.
It's true. You know, I've talked to people about that, too. You know, food costs are going up all over the country. I think in New York, at least, they're able to do the volume consistently, so I guess they can keep their prices down more. But
But their rents have to be higher.
Their rents,
they have to pay taxes, city tax and income tax and all of that.
I hear it all the time. Miami prices, especially in the super high-end places, are higher than any city. I mean, even, you know, Paris, Rome, London, the prices are crazy. I have friends from all over the world who come in and are shocked by, you know, the entree prices that are upwards of $50 in a lot of cases for a piece of fish.
But evidently, people are paying it or they wouldn't continue to have those kind of prices, right?
In some places. I think there's a real mix. You know, even people who can afford those $50 entrees, they really like to find a bargain, too. They love to go to a place they can go to on a Tuesday night and just, you know, get out of there for less than $75 a person. I think the days...
And also, yes, that it has to be really, really good food.
Right.
And very often it's not.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's a major problem.
Exactly.
You sort of don't notice the price if this is like you're wowed and this is fabulous.
That's how I always feel. I always say, you know, I've got two children. I always say I don't mind spending their inheritance on, you know, really great food. But
they don't mind, though.
Well, no, don't tell me. Don't tell them. But, you know, when it's really crummy food, I get really angry. And I know everyone else does, too.
Right.
I'm just surprised about that. You say more people are spending more money on food now than... Are you talking about in Miami, South Florida?
You know, overall, nationwide, actually, statistics are showing... I think the difference is people feel as if the recession is ending or whatever we want to call that. Again, I'm not an economist. But people are feeling less of a pinch. And going out is a thing of enjoyment and also a necessity. With people working a lot, they don't have time. No one's going to go suddenly start cooking. You know what
right.
I mean? The people aren't suddenly learning how to cook. There was a time where we thought there was a return to the kitchen and dining at home and whatever, but the truth is, I think the trend is continuing to go, you know, dining out. If it's not dining out, sitting in a restaurant, picking up food to take out, but eating food, restaurant food is mm-hmm. increasing.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the areas where the Brickell area in Miami is really exploding. So tell us about some of the restaurants in that area.
You know, it's interesting. Brickell is exploding, and they're doing a ton of building for offices and hotels and things. But in terms of actually good quality restaurants, there are not so many, really, that I can endorse. There's a lot of chains, you know. There's the P.F. Chang's, and there are the Irish pubs. And a place that I really, a couple of other places. There are some independents there that I like a lot. Toscana Divina is a lovely place, but a lot of money behind it.
Where is that?
It's next to Mary Brickell Village,
mm-hmm.
or actually right in Mary Brickell Village. Great Italian place. There are also some little spots like La Sandwicherie, and there's I think they have a burger and beer joint that opened over in that place too, and there's a great ramen noodle place called Momi. But, you know, mainly I think the places that are busy are the Rosa Mexicana and the P.F. Chang's and the Ocean Air, you know, the big corporate chains. So, and then, of course, there's Edge, that steakhouse, which is really nice. And now on Brickell Key is a curious little gem.
Oh, that little gem with only 18 tables, is
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's the name of it?
Hard to get into.
Now, N-A-O-E. Used to be in Sunny Isles, and it moved over to Brickell Key. It's a very interesting.
Steak restaurants are the ones that really get me because they will charge you $40 or $50 for a steak, and I can buy a prime cut of beef and slap it on my own grill and make it just as well for $15, $20.
Oh, but then, Fred, you don't have the guys in tuxedos with the white drape over their arm to serve it to you.
See, I have one of those T-shirts that looks like a tuxedo.
Like one in my house.
I don't know about that image, Fred. All right, let's go on to... Well, Brickell, you know, I always think of something like Perricone's.
Yes.
Because they've been there forever, and they do a good job.
They do.
And... it's a good price.
Yeah, they are.
He knows how to run his restaurant.
I would say that's a formula that very much works in Miami. You know, big portions, good prices, a lively vibe, very casual, you know, get you in and out quickly. There's a market. I think that works for that reason.
And they have the outdoors
and
gorgeous,
it's
you
quirky,
know, foliage
the tree
and the trees.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
What do you think
and then
I
was surprised.
Christie's in Coral Gables. They've been there for a
He's still talking
years.
About steak.
You really
talking about steak.
No, I think steakhouses, we just got that invitation, right? The Wolfgang's opening steakhouse. Steakhouses are a huge moneymaker. As you say, there's a big markup, and people like to go out, especially men like to go out to steakhouses.
Well, you know, I was just at PB Steak. And they do a really nice job.
I love that place.
And it's on Purdy, mm-hmm. Purdy, and it's a good price.
It is.
It's a fun place.
That's their intent. Those guys are smart. That's their fifth restaurant on well, fourth on Miami Beach and fifth overall, all opened within about a year and a half, and they're all doing quite well. And I think that's my favorite of them all because they do have a varied menu. They've got great steak. They've got great seafood. They're using modern techniques. They're using, you know, it's very casual. It's young vibe. And the prices are extremely reasonable, especially considering it's on South Beach.
Yeah, yeah. So and easy parking there.
I was going to say, if you can find a parking spot and it's not flooded, then yes, you're good.
But there's parking.
What restaurant are we talking about?
PB Steak.
Oh, I don't even know
PB
it. And where's
is from Pub Belly. The Pub Belly guys who
okay, I haven't. Yeah. Oh, I haven't been to Purdy Avenue since Joe Allen closed.
Oh, you
gotta
well, it's in the Joe Allen
there.
Spot.
If that's where it is.
Oh, okay. There was something else there called Morgan's.
That was there for about 15 minutes, and then it turned into Georgia something, and then it became PB Steak. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
about Brickell, it was interesting to me. You know, Claudio Giordano from Altamar opened on Brickell. And closed within, I have to say, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 months. It was called Tickle on Brickell.
It's closed?
It's closed.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
It was doing, I thought it was doing well. So it just never, and he spent a lot of money opening that. And it's a good restaurateur. So
absolutely.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you never know what's happening. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Victoria Pesch Elliott. She's the restaurant critic for the Miami Herald. We're talking about the explosion of new restaurants in South Florida. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Victoria Pesch Elliott about the explosion of new restaurants in South Florida. Victoria is the Miami Herald restaurant critic. So many openings, so many closing, it's hard to keep up. But for those nights when you're not going out to dinner, we have dinner in minutes. And here's a quick dinner, and it's called teriyaki turkey. Turkey, sweet teriyaki sauce, and crunchy vegetables in an Asian-style dinner. It's really simple. You heat the oil in your skillet or your wok. And here's the secret. Make sure it's really, really hot when you're cooking in a wok. That makes the difference between when you put the food in, it kind of steams, or you want that really crisp coating that you get with a Chinese meal.
Do you do it slowly or quickly to heat the oil?
Well, you have to stay with it, for sure. And make sure your wok is really hot. And here's another secret for wok cooking. Put your food in it a little bit at a time and don't touch it. What we really want to do is we want to stir fry it all the time and toss it right away.
Right.
But you've got the pan hot. You put cold food into it. It has to come back up to heat again. That's the secret. So put your food in, wait a few seconds, a minute, and then start tossing it.
That's a good hint. That's
right.
Good
so hint. You have some sliced onions, some red bell pepper, some bok choy if you want, or just cabbage if you want, some garlic. And I've cut turkey pieces into little bite-sized pieces, and I stir-fry that all about a minute. And then I add the teriyaki sauce. And I look for teriyaki sauce that doesn't have a lot of salt in it. You can get the low-salt ones. And then when the sauce starts to thicken and the turkey's cooked through, it's done. And what I do is I serve that with a little bit of rice. And you can buy rice. You can do a minute rice, or you can do the microwavable brown rice. I love it. 30 seconds in some of them in the microwave, you're done. And no pot to clean, which is the best part.
Right.
Okay.
Linda, you know you can find gluten-free soy sauce now, too.
Can you?
Yeah, for celiacs and gluten-sensitive people, yeah.
Oh, well, that's a great tip, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's good. All right, so read the label and buy what suits you. Well, the complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, are we drinking with steak or what?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good example because steak wines can be kind of expensive, and you can spend less and drink better wine if you bring your own. Now, actually, not every wine fan knows that many restaurants, at least in Miami, will let you bring your own bottle of wine, and they'll open it and pour it for you and charge you what they call a corkage fee, which is often around $20 or so, something like that. And some of my friends that have the absolute best wine cellars like to do this because they will go into a restaurant and see a fabulous 10-year-old wine on the restaurant wine list for $300, and they'll remember that they have the same wine in their cellars, which they brought home 10 years ago for $15 or $20. So it sort of curdles them to pay that much for it.
Right. So, but it's not a good idea, really, maybe to just take in a $10 bottle of wine to the restaurant or something that might be on their wine list.
Well, that's kind of poor form to do it so it's so crassly just to save money. So I think it should be kind of a special wine if you can do it like that.
Well, if you took a $10 bottle of wine, that wouldn't make sense because if there's a $20 corkage fee.
Well, that's true, too.
Right.
Well,
average,
it wouldn't be $10 there.
If you get a wine that you spend $10 for in a grocery store, that'll be like $25 on the wine list.
So minimum.
Or if you're on South Beach, 50.
Exactly, right.
So anyway, before you bring your own bottle, you should call the restaurant and check it out about it. Some won't let you do it at all, and a few will let you do it, but they charge an outrageous fee. There were two restaurants on South Beach a little while ago that were charging $65 to bring your own wine.
Wow.
And one of those closed very quickly after that.
Fred, I have to say, I've talked to some restaurant owners, and their beef was that a lot of people didn't know the proper form, and they were going out and getting, you know, bottles of Plunk and bringing it in, and they, you know, they had a generous corkage fee, perhaps, in the restaurant where it was $20 no matter how many bottles, and people would come in with a party of six or eight people and bring half a dozen bottles of wine and pay the $20 corkage fee and drink, you know, grocery store wine.
And yeah, I know. You're starting to cut into their profits.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big profit zone for them, so you have to... I think, yeah, exactly. People
yeah,
need
to
know
to be
the
reasonable
form.
About it, sure.
Right.
And once you have the okay, you just bring in the bottle and put it on your table and tell the waiter that you arranged with management to do it and to bring it, and they will open it and pour it for you.
It's always nice to give the sommelier a taste, too, if it's something really special.
Yeah, that's a nice touch. And when the bill comes, you'll see the corkage fee on it, but actually you should base your tip not on the corkage fee but on the amount that you would have spent if you bought the bottle there, because you shouldn't penalize the waiter because you brought your own wine.
I hear customers complaining about having to tip on wine sometimes too, though, you know, feeling that they ought not to tip on, you know, when they buy an expensive bottle of wine. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't tip it at a higher at the same percentage. I tip 20% for most things, but if I were ever to buy a $300 bottle of wine, which I actually can't imagine, I would not pay somebody $60 to open that. I would give them $20 to $25, something like that.
Gotcha.
Because it's no more work for the waiter, unless the waiter went out and found you something rare that you've been looking for all the time. And you know, if he did some major work for you, then you want to reward him.
Right. That sounds about right.
But overall, bringing your own wine can mean spending less.
Sure. Well, do you tip if it's the waiter, you tip for the whole meal, but if there's a sommelier there, do you tip that separately?
Yeah, and then you don't tip the waiter separately for the wine, just for the food then.
So you just do tip the sommelier.
Well, how do you do that?
Well, you tip the sommelier for the price of the wine, and you tip
the
waiter for the price of the meal.
Right.
Most restaurants that I know about or talk about, they do like a tip-sharing program amongst the staff anyway.
So
true.
They all have to...
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Okay. So, Fred, any more information?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right, I thought we were going to tell me what I'm going to drink with my steak.
Oh, with your steak. Oh, well, you know, a good steak wine is always Cabernet Sauvignon, and... actually, Robert Mondavi makes a wonderful one. He has one that you can get in a store for about $20, or if you want to splurge, he has one that you can spend $125 for.
All right.
And Cabernets have the heft and the tannin. You need some tannin to cut through the fat if you have a nice ribeye steak that's well marbled and that sort of thing. That's the way to go with that.
All right. So we've been talking about the Brickell area, and your specialty is really down in Miami-Dade, but is there an explosion of restaurants going up in Broward and all?
I think there's a similar explosion going on in Broward and also in Palm Beach, but like Miami, there are a lot of duplicates or formulas that have worked with one place that are then being replicated. Landlords and banks tend to like to see a sure thing, and you don't see a lot of first-timers opening up there. They're pretty conservative. I don't spend a ton of time up there.
So in other words, the banks want to make sure that there's some capital behind that restaurant.
Right, and some experience. I mean, I think Chef Angelo Elia from Casa D'Angelo in Fort Lauderdale and Boca Raton, he's opened a new place in Country Isle Plaza in Weston, And I think he's, you know, he knows the formula too, what works there, sort of casual, well-priced, good value. He knows his audience and it works.
And that seems to be the theme these days.
It is.
Right.
With some exception, you know, there are these imports like Milos, these super expensive, you know, spots.
And I thought it's interesting that Michael's Genuine, which was the first real casual, fun
right.
kind of place opening around here, he's gone the other way. He's a white tablecloth restaurant now.
I think that was very risky and a very good, I think it's a great thing for those people who really enjoy fine and unusual and somewhat adventurous food. It's very intimate. I think there's 40 seats there. I love it. I think it's really a good call for real foodies who are willing to splurge on. I like that a lot.
What's that called? Crystal?
Cypress Room.
Cypress.
And where is that?
Yeah, he's got the cuisine to back it up.
Absolutely. He's got the skill. And you know, he also just opened in the Rally. I was just there last night.
And where's the Crystal Room?
Cypress. Cypress Room is sort
Cypress.
Of under
Cypress,
the,
sorry.
Yeah, sort of under the overpass right on your way into the design district. I guess that's about 37th Street. There was a wine restaurant there before.
Not the charcuterie.
Next door.
Next door,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Next door to what used to be the charcuterie.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So interesting. He's going the other way.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Midtown and the design district and MIMO. And, I mean, come on. They're all
and Buena Vista.
Yeah.
And Norton.
Where are we?
And the Upper East Side. I think it's funny because these areas are, you know, sometimes they describe a three-block, you know, three-block radius.
Right.
I think they all kind of blend together. And, you know, if you start at the lowest, I guess Wynwood would be sort of 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th Street, mixed in with Midtown, and then Design District from 33rd, 34th, and then Buena Vista north of there, Upper East Side and MIMO going on from there. And there's a lot of stuff happening in all of those areas, although I have to say I'm shocked at the rents in Midtown now going through the roof. Acme Baking just closed because the rents were too high, but they just opened.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So it's difficult. In other words, so check on the restaurant before you go to it.
Definitely.
It's a shame because the area becomes derelict because they can't afford
to
stay there.
Landlords just, you know, they see a little bit of excitement, all of a sudden the rents go crazy. I think it's, I think they should slow down a little bit and try to keep things, you know, normalize things and not get greedy.
You know, what we need is some old ramshackle wooden shack restaurants like you have in the Keys.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. And Victoria, great information. Thank you so much. Victoria Pesch Elliott, always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Barney Berman, nice chatting with you today.
Nice to be here.
And next week, we'll be talking about more food news and views. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps us up. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with the South Florida History Quiz, featuring historian Dr. Paul George. What was the business of Henry Flagler, which went belly up before his partnership with Rockefeller? We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Now our All Florida calendar. On this day in 1539, 564 years ago, conquistador Hernando de Soto lands with 9 ships, 632 men, 223 horses, and 13 pigs around Bradenton. The Porcine descendants still flourish. And on this day in 1956, 57 years ago, a bus boycott begins in Tallahassee, prompted by 2 FAMU students refusing to give up seats to white passengers. And one more. We recall the figure Time magazine dubbed the grand old man of Florida politics. On this day in 1989, 23 years ago, the death of U.S. Congressman and Senator Claude Pepper. He lost the legendary 1950 Senate primary election to George Smathers, but served in the House from 1962 until his death. His successor was Ileana Ross Leighton. Pepper is the only Floridian whose body lay in state under the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. And this from Claude Pepper, the son of sharecroppers, quote, A stockbroker urged me to buy a stock that would triple its value every year. I told him, at my age, I don't even buy green bananas. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.